and Sylvia Plath. The reading's been prepared by P.L. Skinner and Chris Kennedy. And the readers will be Chris Kennedy, Linda Leshinsky, and Professor Roger Bowen of the English Department. I hope that you can come to the Student Union and meet Susan Schaefer after the reading tonight. We'll be in the terrace lounge with the usual punch and cookies. We never pay for our punch and cookies, but we're still getting them. That's very nice. Several people have come up to me in the last few years and complained that they couldn't find books by visiting writers. So Blue Moon Press has agreed to sell books following the readings. And they'll have a table at the reception with some of Mrs. Schaefer's work and also copies of Patients of Blue Moon Press, the Blue Moon News, and their chapbooks, and also copies of Grilled Flowers. Susan Schaefer has had published 4 books of poetry and 2 novels since 1972. Her books of poetry are The Witch and the Weather Report, Granite Lady, The Rhymes and Runes of the Toad, and most recently, Alphabet for the Lost Years. Her novels are Falling and Anya. She teaches at Brooklyn College. We're very happy to welcome her to our campus. Susan Fromberg Schaefer.
I asked just before I came here if there were such things as daffodils here. I didn't mean this any kind of slur on the West as opposed to the East, but my ignorance is beginning to bother me. I saw planes taking off with parachutes. I saw planes with parachutes and didn't know if they were taking off or landing, and decided I had better ask some questions before I made any assumptions about anything. The first poem I'd like to read is called Confession in April, and this has to do with my garden. That's what the daffodil question was about. Also, it has to do with my refusal to admit that the summer is over. It's much colder in New York than it is here. It's a poem that started when I planted a great many bulbs in our garden when we had first moved into the house, and was assured by the gardener that they were tulip bulbs, which are my favorite flowers. And when spring came, I was in for a surprise. And this is the poem that came from this unusual effort on my part. It's called Confession in April. Dear Lord, I have sinned against thee, for I do not love all flowers equally. For daffodils have come up in my yard instead of tulips, for I hate their stupid yellow faces, and I say they are no better than weeds. For I have turned spiteful and admire the cats who do bite through their necks. For I finger my calluses from the planting and resent them still further. For I blame them for their nature. Yet once planted, they could be but what they are. For I resent the earth that they eat in their growing. For even the crow who devoured a nestling before me is more accepted in my sight. For I will not accept them and say I cannot. For if I had courage, I would root them up by their heads and leave them as carcasses. For my anger is implacable against them, yet they grow in clusters like families and still are detestable. For I say, how could this happen, as if it counted to measure? For I tell myself I like the barrenness better. For I act as if this were the last year. For I encourage the winds against them and hate the rains which suckle them up. For I walk neither to the right nor left, but would trample upon them. For in the morning I wish it were evening, so they would be gone from my sight. For I cannot forgive. For all day my face is pressed against the glass, and my eye is evil. For I eye my neighbor's hose and will it to burst and drown them entirely. For they seem so proud. For they have spent the winter feeling worms at their white skins and have not complained to the air. They do not cry out, we are cold, though the wind blows against Raleigh. or against heat when the sun bakes down upon them, for not really ugly. For much can be said to assert them, yet they anger me beyond all sanity, for I suspect their connivance against my favorite roses, for their golds are gall to me, for in truth my will is not done. Temper tantrum poem. These next poems come from a long series which constitutes a good portion of the book Alphabet for the Lost Years. And when I started writing this alphabet series, I knew how many letters there were in the alphabet, that there were 26. But after I began, the 26 began to seem like a much larger number than it had seemed when I first began. So I will not torture everybody with all 26 letters. I've picked out some of them from A to Z. A, at the beginning was the arch, but its shape was strange. It had a small tail. It was alive. So it was inevitable everyone went through. Now it has eaten its tail. It stands in its stones, the air more solid than stones. E. Some of these are like riddles, and if the letter is the only title, then part of the poem is to figure out what the letter stands for. E. The round thing where it all begins, the small sun under gelatinous clouds, they shift, white and warm and speckled. It seems there are times nothing prevents them. The Chinese bury some for years, trusting them only to earth. They cook in its fires. Delicacies singing the songs of the skull, the new roots of grass. In China is also a great wall, in places shattered like a venerable egg. F. When it grows its green cover, the cows come. In spring, covered with green fuzz, like the skull of a baby. By summer, it riots. There are lovers in the clover and under. Everywhere there are soldiers, tin pictures slipping through bone cage. For hundreds of years, for centuries out of mind, the head of a man speaks to the head of a cow. The field eats them all. T. Which everyone can probably guess immediately after the first poem I read. All winter they lie in the black earth. They are blind in the eyes. Their sleep more deep than the dead. They sleep without, for they save themselves up. Then something touches them. Their dark wombs open. They have been buried alive. In their perpetuity, their blooms contradict the seasons of grayness and cold. From them it is clear, the flesh it is golden, and in the long afternoons consumes itself in violent fires. And the petals tire quickly, throwing their heads back in the air, resembling poppies, age taking its tuck in their skins. Now before their necks droop with the last harsh cry of swans, they show their black mouths, the black sun seed in the gold. Thin green women without shawls, they prepare to descend the long steps to the chill into black earth. They never look back. Z. A man is asleep in the sun. He does, a bee buzzes. The air is drugged. Somewhere a man is sawing his wood. Sun gilds him. The cut wood glows. The willow bends over the water, washing its hair. Boys swing from its branches. The river confesses its sins to the sins of the bank. The boys fall into water in peacocks of silver. One has fallen asleep under a tree. The sawing and sawing puts the man's wife to sleep. Standing, he nods in the sun. The cat is asleep on the rock. Warm blood in the air, the season buzzes. A bee settles itself on the skin. This next poem, The Bible of the Beasts of the Little Field, is a long poem, and I'm not sure whether it's necessary to have a Bible or not to understand it, but since it's a long poem and since people probably haven't read it, the last few lines of the poem have to do with the story of Jonah in the Bible. Are people familiar with the story of Jonah in the Bible? At the end of, it's one of the funny, few funny stories in the Bible. At the end of the story of Jonah, Jonah is so angry with God after having sent him on this mission to warn everybody that Nineveh was going to be destroyed. Then God changes his mind, so Jonah's trip in the whale has been useless, that he gets very angry and gives God a lecture and essentially says, you ought to destroy it after all that you've put me through. And God argues with him, saying he likes the gourd that he's sitting under, which gives him shade in the desert, and how would he like it if that were killed? And therefore, should he destroy Nineveh, which is filled with stupid people, and also has many in it. And that's the end of the story. And Jonah loses the argument. And this poem depends on some knowledge of the Jonah story, I think. One, I was born unacquainted, the beasts say. I was born unacquainted. Everything that creeps and flies through the firmament and swims the deep places. And they say unto us, who is to say that our breaths go down and yours go up, and we are struck dumb, saying, I know you not, I do not know you, we have become unacquainted. Two, let me number in this new yard as I can a multitude of cats, both little and large, both one color and brindled, some friendly, some not, some lame, some strong-legged, some birds of many description, some red on the head, others on the chest, little brown ones, numerous as the seeds they do eat, a hammer at wood, two strolling pigeons with breastplates of Persian enamel, who feel no fear, who walk about my toes, who in the morning call to each other with the thick sound of water, gushing from all the deep places, and one red cardinal, and also two blue jays. Three, let us consider the animals in the spring. The Abyssinian mistress has brought forth three black kittens. In numberless leaves, they number three. Their nest is an old car. Its pipes are their toys. They will not know us, though we bring milk forth to them. They stare at us seriously out of blue button eyes. How the mighty have fallen. No, I am Ruth amidst ailing in corn, and I have multiplied after my kind. Black queen, my queen. Four, is there no end to the humans and all their fenced cities who tend to their vines and the green blood touches their hands and now they want red? The man in the house after is a reproach and a lament. As they pass by, people hiss at him, yet he is innocently clipping his vines. There was a man who took bricks and threw them. This is the man, for he has taken a cat and broken its back, for it has crawled to its dying in the yard of the priest. And what shall be his punishment? For he has set a trap and caught the cat called Nameless, and Nameless is crippled. And what shall his punishment be? For we have fed Nameless and tried to minister. For there is much to this matter, as a tree with two leaves may spread its roots through the yard. For we must consider Nameless, the cat who was crippled. Five. Angel with four faces, one of lion, one ox, one eagle. Come down, angel with four wings, always going straight as you gaze, resting on your two rings, one moving you forward, one turning, and each ring full of eyes. For the spirit of the angel rests in the wheels. Can you inspire such wonder as Nameless? For Nameless is my savior. He has caused me to green into life as a dry root in water, as a wire into its current, as each green leaf to the sun, to turn from my winter to come forth green and golden, my earth full of petals, my branches heavy with leaves. 6. Wherefore did this cat say, yea, I shall live? His skin hung on him, his bones showed through him like lathing of a dwelling that hath not yet been plastered. White was his fur with considerable gray patches. A map of despair is he, so said we of him, meant on his way by us. He walked in pure pain as a tree that catches on fire. Up the fence of pain he went, his fourth leg with him, and down again into the yard. So he slept before the priest, so he slept before me. By lifting their heads, others could scare him off milk. He lay in the greens, and the rain brought him mud splattered. Heavy was the air, and the flying bugs crowned him as if he had died there. He left, and the earth turned to iron. He came again, and the earth turned to gold. Fat and happy was the cat, for Missy the cat has given him her protection, for he has given her kittens. For his fourth foot rests on the ground and almost will bear him, for he has dug through the wall called despair and has seen the green sea. For he has let me press my eye to it, although he constantly hisses. For he had touched his head, which was the head of a savage. On that day I was anointed. On that day I had faith. 7. Under the sun I sat on the earth and considered. I considered the little hill in its baldness. I considered the little seeds in their pouches and how the two should be joined. And as I sat, the sky was blue and the earth was chocolate. So I took up my trowel and on the earth's first turning discovered the worm. And the worm was not usual. No, he was wide as my finger. And his color was a dull pink as the inner part of a body. And although he was startled under my eye, he made his way along the little hill. And I wondered that I did not fear him or feel disgust at him, but thought I could even see on his body the head which made the rest ripple after, as if it were a living wave, and thought how he went down deep into the cold earth, making all his apartments, learning the road marks of pebbles, and how the sun did not shine for him or the moon, yet still he comes up in tribute to see them, and then makes his bed in the absolute dark. And I thought then of the flowers, and how they bore living. One short season nodding in the pleasant rains and sun showers, then fisting back to bulbs for 10 long months of dreams. 10 months of dreams, so long for dreams. No wonder their timbrels and psalteries and little bells play so in the yard, and their music starts the season to ticking, nor does the worm harm them. 10 months of dreams. When they come, they are emptied out of them. Their sight is as the clear glass. They see what is here, and I saw them and envied, and the little worm made his way from me. 8. Lord, the great tree has cast a squirrel down before me, and the neighbors all say, take him up and make him to eat, for he is only a baby. He lies in this box as he lay on the ground, arms spread out as if flying, and little legs also. And his eyes do not wink, but stare only. Though the wind ruffles the fur of his comely gray tail, he is dead. Yet I have put sugared milk on his lips, for he might wake in his box. And if it were deep, the worm's will would fail him, the baby's sky darken, and I could never explain. He is dead, says the weather. Nor let my light does not make his eye to blink, says the sun, nor to water, nor does the wind do aught but stir him. Through his small nose comes no little breeze of his own. The small children think he is sleeping. Good night, they say under the trees. Ellen took up his pose. He took up his pose and he died. Yet we have nameless. Shall I destroy Nineveh, that great city, said the Lord, wherein the people do not know their left hand from their right, and also much cattle. and also my nameless, and also my nameless. I'm not sure I should say this about this poem. In the college where I teach, we have to, I don't know if they do that here. Do they do that here? Senior members of the faculty go in and listen to junior members of the faculty to make sure they're not doing atrocious things, like teaching, whatever. Well, this is one of the most boring activities they've thought up at Brooklyn College, and whenever possible, as long as the person appears sane and doesn't seem trying to eat the chalk or the eraser, I'll do anything so that the hour will pass quickly. And during this particular hour, I wrote one of these poems. I actually wrote two. I was so desperate. The class was so boring. But a boring class, that is not reportable. Only a class in which the students are interested and possibly not doing the prescribed material is reportable. So I could see the writing on the wall, and I thought I would do some of my own. And this is one of them. It's called The Raven Trees. In the raven trees, there is a stirring of wings. There is a fluttering of blinks in the raven trees. There are green eyes clustering like grapes in the raven trees. There is a white frame house, and oh, it is proper. There is an expanse of black grass between the house and the raven trees. Oh, lords and ladies, imagining cherubim and tiny hearts, imagining hawks, vultures, crows, why can you meet only the white snowfalls on the black grass, covering the black grass, the white house, the pale sun, the raven trees? This poem I'm about to read next is about a cemetery in Vermont, which dates back to about 1803. And after about a month of pestering my husband, who hates cemeteries, he finally agreed to go with me, although he's convinced that visiting a cemetery is an extremely morbid thing to do. So I thought it was relatively harmless, since all we would have to do is walk up and down among the stones, and I could write down what information it was that I wanted. But naturally, as things would have it, he now has plenty of grounds to complain. If any of you have seen movies like The Exorcist, or recently that movie with Gregory Peck, The Omen, something always happens, and something always falls down. Well, for some reason in a movie, it never really seems very frightening. But when something really falls down in a real cemetery, I discovered that's another matter altogether. So I imagine this was my last trip to the cemetery with my husband, who is now convinced that the cemetery had some form of protest of its own about our being there in the first place. It's called The Moles, Twitchell Cemetery, Vermont. They keep charts of all the cemeteries and names and genealogies, but they sometimes neglect to put back up the stones that fall down. God only knows what we were doing there, visiting Freddie, so long dead, in that place of stopped hearts, as if he were ours, ours only, died 1818, age 4 years, 9 months. Perhaps it was merely his stone, perhaps not Freddie at all, but his father, younger than we were that day, that year, 1818, who carved the little lamb stroke by stroke out of found marble until he fashioned a shape for his own heart, until he felt each stroke of his blade. Not as sentimental as we had first thought, a lamb, not a puppy, not the child's pet, meaning, as did the stone of his sister, gone home. Oh, it was a strange day, as if blackbirds were stirring the air to storm everywhere, the cold white clouds, the stunning blue sky, and the mountains rising, stones over the stones, waves out of the flood, the stones in the midst of that greenery signaling winter, its endless separating snows, making those drifts seem for the moment tame, nothing fearful. Never before did we feel so helpless in the face of enormity, shrunk to this little lamb who gazed at us out of his black eye, old shoulder, while the black mold mottled his back, and the picturesque stones tilting this way and that, a forgotten town all askew. And we were naive to lean so on his sister, poor Emmeline, who died in the second summer, and her stone fell straight back, the crown piece flying furthest, one stone in three pieces. What a horror, as if a god had fallen. And how fast we jumped to put up that heavy marble, one pin holding the big slab like the pin in the hip of a soldier, the other two plates in the head of a skull. Poor Emmeline, we said then, she never had luck. It was then that we noticed the feel of the ground and the dates of the parents who lived 36 years after Freddie, waiting 10 for Emmeline. And when she was gone, no foolish carving for that spongy ground, that ground that seemed so ready to let the boot through to that we walked on. It didn't feel right walking on the dead, and then it did, as if this were the earth's crust, and now given up all disguises. We kept telling ourselves they were down deep, but after the fall of that stone, it was hard to believe it. When we realized it was only moles, little moles, hundreds of them, tunneling the loam, creating this terror our boots would go through to poor Emmeline and poor Freddie. Those sleek moles, opposes of gardens, and we thought as we left, or thought we left through the white wicket, this was the wrong garden for them. The fruits were too deep for their paws and their noses, but the lamb's blank eye caught us. And as if we could read the mole's notes, we knew finally and forever those furry, destroying angels with their sharp teeth and their earth song, their deep mission and worm tunnels. And though little Freddy haunted our sleep like one of the quickest, we would always be wrong. This poem was written for one of my students who fell madly in love every 3 weeks for about a period of 2 years. And whenever she fell madly in love, everything was completely simple and clear to her. That was the first week. The second week, she would entertain some doubts. And the third week, she would be considering committing suicide or having her personality altered in some surgical manner, since she was obviously inadequate. And after listening to her for approximately 5 years, I decided I would write a poem about love just because I couldn't stand it anymore. And the condition she was usually in, she wasn't fit to talk to. So I thought if I wrote it down, perhaps it would do some good. I don't know whether it did it or not. At least she hasn't mentioned the subject lately. And I haven't noticed any new engagement rings changing every month on her finger. So I think it may just be age. I doubt if she's had any surgery or had her stomach pumped. But this is the result of constant romantic torment, which makes As the World Turns look extremely tame. It's almost enough to wean me from television altogether. Love. Why is love so difficult? At the very word, the heart surrounds itself with briars. But the thorns have their own secrets. With tears, his sword slashes through, his face is gashed, his clothes cut to pieces. When he finds her, his tears and his blood varnish her face. He is already full of joys and resentments, and she is ecstatic. Though the coffin's glass smash surely upsets her. Her face is sticky. She asks for his handkerchief, and he sees its stain. He does not say what he feels, nor does she, looking at its tarnishing blood as they walk home, talking of home. They know not what they say. They are so full of plans. I will bandage the wall with drapes and wig the ball windows with ruffledom. The eyes of the house shall not stare like wide open lids, stiff and unclosing. We shall have blinds. And he says, look, I have seen these boards somewhere before, and this narrow room. Someday it will warm. We can feed those shrill cries, and mirrors forbidden us are no loss. Small faces shall give back our own. What is that chill wind but a deep breath? What is that cough in the attic? I know there are fast flowers in the plaster. They are drawn to the bodies. From the minute they slammed the door, they smelled earth. They argued with each other like lawyers. They picked each other's pockets. Someone always woke in the night and stole from the room. The shadows were thick. Each confided in the moon. There were the illnesses and the recriminations, and that mad lady memory locked herself in the guest room. When they could not get her out, they fed her under the door. Strange to say, everything prospered. Though the cat they fed ate the pigeon who fed on their crumbs, and when it was over, there were others left who cried, and one patched cat who kept returning to the scene of the crime saying, though no one understood, this was love, this was happiness. And I, too, between hunting the birds and the squirrels and the one pigeon remaining, take time out to mourn. The more I look at these, the more I think they have to do with either students or friends, or both. There comes a point where they become inseparable, especially when they start teaching in the same department you're in. They becomes entirely inseparable. This poem, I think, had something to do with once with somebody who seemed to want to spend her life doing her graduate work. And her goal seemed to be to finish it 24 hours before she died of old age. And I'm not sure how closely related the two things are, but one day after 8 years on the second year of the PhD, I found myself writing this, so I suspect there must be some kind of connection. It's called When. When does life begin, she asked. There is always the lace metal ball full of snakes, its intricacies to consider, and the gold knife to slice the gold apple, which has no thin it, yet each piece grows into a hole. And we have not even mentioned the flying white horse or the possibility of traveling unseen, but still leaving tracks on the sand, or the small crystal globe sunk in the palm of my hand, in which I can see the future coming closer, although lately the future resembles a pillar of smoke. There are rumors of new plagues. Surely you've heard them. And I can never forget the two sisters, one of them blind. They never knew they were twins. Then the oracle spoke, quick, into the scald cauldron. Terrible are the burns and the scars. They will heal late, which is better than never. That land, healthy as a hog. Poems are nastier than I thought. This one is a poem about somebody I don't like, who is quite famous. And for good reasons, her name has been omitted, even in anagrams and acrostics and things of that sort. We've known each other for a long time, largely because there are some people who insist upon knowing you whether you want to or not. But this one is called Famous, and it's about somebody who everyone, I'm sure, in this room has seen pictures of, however. I will behave myself for change and not mention who it is. Well, I'd be curious to see who guessed, but that's not fair. Famous. Fame was that dame she ate on and served until a gold halo grew overhead, but it hummed with the dark sound of bees, has closed against her. Even the moon heard the slam of wood doors. Jealousy, she cried in despair with a pout. But a housewife with a big mouth and belly could not help herself. While you slept, the stethoscope sounded your chest. It is filled with the black sound of bees, the gold sting of wasps, and wasps, wasps only for your dowry. And it seems to have been prophetic, too, which gives me more nasty satisfaction than is really desirable in a person. This poem is from a book I wrote called Rhymes and Runes of the Toad. It's all about a toad, or various toads and their various adventures. And this one seems to have appealed to fathers more than I thought it would. I've gotten more letters from fathers detailing all the sins of their children since this book has come out. Fathers are a neglected commodity, I've discovered, in this society. I think that's probably why Joseph Hell or Something Happened was so popular. The book, has anyone read that book? He spends a great deal of time describing why he hates his children, his wife. Usually you have Philip Roth complaining about his mother. This one you have the father complaining about the children. It's an interesting sociological development, if nothing else. But the father hasn't been heard from much in this society or century. This one is called Paternal Toad. Finally, Toad had children. Toad took fatherhood very seriously, especially since, being a toad, he had hundreds of them. One cold afternoon in the fall, when the leaves were beginning to fall and the ponds were lacing with ice, he called them all to him. He took his place upon a rock, and they sat down below, leaf green and gray, leaf green and beige. "It is time for me to tell you how the world came to begin," said the toad. "First there was blackness, then a red ball of fire rose in the sky, then darkness again, then a white ball of fire, not nearly so hot, and so the pattern was set." "What happened next?" they chorused, their minds all agog. At this, Toad threw himself down on his rock and sobbed himself sick. I don't know if any of you have ever read anything about Freud's study of the wolf man. It's about a man who thought he was a wolf, not a werewolf, thought he was a wolf a great deal of the time. Or rather, he didn't think he was a wolf much of the time. He was afraid wolves were after him all of the time. I think that was I think he only had a very brief interval of thinking he himself might be turning into a wolf and have to do all these dreadful things. This poem is about a picture that the Wolfman, that's what he called himself, the Wolfman, and that's what Freud also called him, drew to show Freud what the wolves looked like when they stood outside his window at night. They sat in a tree and watched him. And so that Freud couldn't possibly think he was imagining it, he drew the picture and it would all be clear. It's on the cover of the book. It's a very nice picture, but when you realize someone took it seriously, it somehow loses its charm in some ways. The picture, Wolves in the Tree. This is dedicated to Cynthia Ozick, who's an extremely talented short story and who hates Freud. But she's made an exception for these wolves in their tree, so. In the picture, five white wolves sit in a tree. The sixth has hidden himself in the works of a grandfather clock. They are afraid of being eaten, but of course this is what happens. They are not really wolves, but six woolly lambs. They only pretend to be wolves. They are afraid of the wolf. They sit in a blasted tree in a desolate, snow-covered steppe. They all stare straight ahead. Blue pines are jagged behind them. It is a mystery how they got up there. It is a mystery how the wolf eats them. They seem to be made of the snow and are not very nourishing, but still, they are eaten. The sixth deserves our concern, crouched stiffly and patiently under the pendulum and waits. When is it safe to come out? He thinks of his brothers in the tree in the snow. He thinks of the north wind puffing the face of the clock. He wants to sneeze from the dust. There are two possible ends to his story. In one, the constant tickings and chimings drive him quite mad. The tickings turn slowly to snow. He digs his way out, smears himself with butter, and lies down on the hearth of the wolf. He wears a little red hood for good measure. The wolf is surprised, but knows just what to do. In the other, he comes out, thinner but wiser, knows his pulse is a clock, and goes to the market for wives. He brings home a fat one. He has 14 children and teaches them hopscotch as he used to play it. He makes a good living building grandfather clocks. They are all big enough for a fat sheep to sleep in. He keeps a huge pot boiling under his chimney, his house, of course, made of brick. At night, his wife is often quiet and takes off her apron and asks, what's it all for? He says the perpetuation of hopscotch and turns on his side. When he dies, the whole village calls him the sage. This is a poem that I wrote quite a long time ago, before it really was popular to start chewing through your wrist if you discovered you were a housewife primarily and not a upcoming female president of the United States. And since then, it's been anthologized a great deal in feminist places, which is nice, a little bit disturbing to me, because the poem is about both the man and the woman. And it's always been hard for me to imagine how a woman gets herself into circumstances which are going to drive her insane without giving consent of some kind, since there's always the bus or mother or something. But this poem has really been read didactically. I still like it, and that's why I would like to read it. There is a problem, I think, for everybody once you commit yourself to a certain way of life and a certain number of tasks. And this one, in my mind, was about somebody who had chosen to stay home. And that was it. I didn't really see the person as a victim of society or a person who was oppressed by society. Still, you can't force read things the way you want them read, so maybe there's something wrong with the way I wrote it in that case. But housewife. What can be wrong that some days I hug this house about me like a shawl and feel each window like a tatter in its skin, or worse, bright eyes I must not look through? Now my husband stands above me as high as ever my father did, and I am in that house of dolls which, when young, I could not shrink to. I feel the shrinkage in each bone. No matter what I do, my two girls spoil like fruit. Already they push us back like two full plates. They play with us like dolls. The road before the house is like a wish that stretches out and out and will not stop. And the smallest hills are built like steps to the slippery moon. But I circle this lit house like any moth, and see each day open its fingers to disclose the stone, which hand, and the stone in both. Once I drove my car into a tree. The bottles in the back burst like bombs, tubular glass beasts giving up the ghosts. My husband thought it was the road. It was. In the rearview mirror, it curved and curled, longer and stronger than the road ahead. A question of perspective, I thought then. I watched it until it turned, and I did not. I breathed in pain like air, as if I, the rib, had cracked. I did not feel this pain, not then, almost in my mouth. I wriggle this life and find it loose. Like my girls, I would pull it out, would watch something new and white push like mushrooms from the rich red soil, but there is just this hole, this bone. So I live inside my wedding ring, beneath its arch, multiplying the tables of my days, learning the lessons of this dish, that sleeve, wanting the book that no one wrote, loving my husband, my children, my house, with this pain in my jaw, wanting to go. Do others feel like this? What do they do? This is a poem that I wrote after I had some experience with the same situation and realized how it wasn't terribly difficult to become reasonably insane from lack of time. That there were actually times when you would check the clock to see if you had as much as 30 seconds or even 20, and if you only had 8, could become quite frantic. It's called The Windows. And it's about one of the peaceful times. The morning light sanctifies all the terrible objects, the knives, the simple dishes, which return in their tiny orbits again and again like used moons, and also the strange silence of this 1 hour before creation, and my own breath is not human. The morning light sanctifies all the terrible objects, the knives, the serviceable dishes, which return in their tiny orbits again and again like used moons, and also the strange silence of this 1 hour before creation, and my own breath is not human, but is a breeze through the winds and the rushes, and my bones are not yet, but green saplings saying what soon will be, and the yard has gathered time to itself in its greenery. There is no human element. The human element is not yet. The trees dance, the wind blows, blue jays drink of the cracked fountain, the sun opens petal by petal, and the clouds move in their silence. They fly in flocks like white geese. They are intelligent. Little waters puddle and splash, sing, see the flood has pulled back. There is a sighing that compasses everything. Yes, it even rests on 4 pillars, and the willow bends its hair to the blowing, and the sky's ancient silks billow in blueness up and again. Now the flowers do speak one to the other, and even bend down to the little worm who goes so hard through his tunnel. With joy they open their mouths to the tigery bee. This is before everything. Yes, it is true, an angel stands at the gate. Although there is no gate, yet there is one indeed. Oh, this is before, and all is still then, but my heart crawls with time, fills with it like burrowing ants. To them I am only more earth. In a pointy white tower, a steeple, a petal splash of peelings, a blazing forth of the sun, a throat cry, the ivy becomes ivy, my hands become my hands, the cat crosses the yard, she has divided, her eyes full of purpose. And in the high tower, I see the round face with its numbers, veined marble and iron. So the air fills with tickings, so my blood ticks, so the room now ticks to their purpose. Thus the hands of the clock are the flaming swords of angels. So this little time comes to a close. This is the last poem I'm going to read. It's called When I Spoke. It's short. Trouble with writing long poems is that not only do you have to type them, but reading them takes longer than reading short ones. I like the short ones. Looks like a blank page by comparison. When I spoke to the cows, they would not answer, neither the horses. They changed their minds, speaking of the one day they would no longer be dumb. It was then that I realized the sun and the moon had gone out. A chill had set in, my lips sealed, bones glacial. Thank you very much.